Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by
Angel Manuel Soto, the director of Charm City Kings,
which hits HBO Max tomorrow, Thursday, October 8th. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, man, thank you for having me.
Where are you joining us from? Are you in LA or where are you?
Yeah, I've been in quarantine, held captive in my house in LA right now.
Me too, man. I haven't been inside another building since like March, so I know what you mean.
Exactly. It's a crazy time, but we gotta do what we gotta do.
So when it premiered, it's funny you mentioned that when it premiered at Sundance in January, you know, you had no idea. You thought maybe
no
even
idea.
Thought it would have like a limited theatrical release or something maybe. But just talk about how maybe it is sort of a blessing that it's on HBO and Max. Everyone's been quarantining and here you are with a streaming release. It kind of works out, right?
It kind of works out. Yeah. You know, it was crazy because at first, when the movie was picked up first by Sony Pictures Classics, nobody really knew where we wanted to go, what was the route we wanted to take. And I pushed for the festival route. I come from the international festival circuit. That's kind of like my comfort zone. But being this the first time on participating with a feature film on the American circuit, I really wanted to give it a try. And boy, did that pay off. Not only got selected, but it also won special jury award for best ensemble cast. And with that together, the idea of maybe a limited theatrical release bumped up to 1,300 theaters in April. So we were very excited for this wide release in April. And then I guess it almost was like the next week or something. I know that I was in Puerto Rico for a wedding. And that's when we started hearing the news and everything was getting like crazy and the lockdowns. And me and my fiance, we have our life here in LA. So we had to like fly back earlier, push our flight to leave earlier and stay here. And through that whole moment, it was kind of like the excruciating seeing how it got pushed and then seeing what was going to happen because they decided to push everything to 2021. And luckily, we had HBO who saw the film, who loved it, who became very, very passionate about the movie and decided to take it and release it on HBO Max. And it took a while because to kind of like understand the impact that this would have, but the good thing about the people at HBO is that they have been very graceful in carrying us through the whole process from marketing to everything in between. And their plan was beautifully executed and very well strategized to the point that I really felt that it was in good hands. The movie is in good hands. It's going to be releasing tomorrow. And what could have been, chaos because of COVID, now it became an opportunity that more than 50 million people can see.
Yep, it all sort of works out. All right, well, let's tell our listeners what it's about. I know it's based on, let's start with the documentary 12 O'Clock Boys it came out in 2013 by Lofty Nathan, premiered at South by Southwest. I think it played in Baltimore at the Maryland Film Fest in 2013. So some of our listeners may have seen it a few years ago. But tell us what that documentary was about.
Well, the documentary was very, it followed this kid called Pug and his family and his passion for bikes. But I believe that one of the things that really inspired not only me, but the writers and Jada and Will was also how it depicted a subculture that hadn't been exploited in a way or hadn't been had the attention that it deserved. And it was shot in such a way that made it very appealing and beautiful and artistic. And there wasn't really a story behind that documentary, but there was a powerful world that we can base the story from. And that's when Barry Jenkins came in and did a draft that I read. And that's when I jumped into the project, when I saw a lot of mouse in the way that I grew up and life in Puerto Rico. I was able to really find the common denominators between Baltimore and Puerto Rico and be able to tell my story there. And through that whole process with Chairman Payne, when he came over and took over the rewrites after Barry went to the Moonlight, Chairman also brought in his own examples and was able to craft this coming of age story that really relied on the authenticity of the characters, of the authenticity of being a teenager and innocence, and also on the beauty and the uniqueness that Baltimore has as a city and its people.
Awesome. There's so much you said that I want to unpack, but let's start with, I definitely want to get to, you know, your the parallels to Puerto Rico too, in a minute, but, let's start with what you mentioned. So Will and Jada Pinkett Smith, I guess saw the documentary, Barry Jenkins saw the documentary and were inspired to, well, the Smiths produced it and Barry Jenkins, wrote a draft. How much of Barry Jenkins' original draft remains? And, you know, why? So you said he left to do Moonlight and that's why Sherman Payne took over?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't part of the project when all of this was happening. This was before I came in. I jumped into the project around the fall of 2017, right after Hurricane Maria flew over Puerto Rico. And I remember that was the script that I got. But they were already working with Sherman and being able to tackle some of the notes. And a lot of the energy I feel in terms of the subtextual topics that the movie explores, those are very much anchored in the sensibility that was written on a more introspective script from Barry Jenkins. And I think that what Sherman did very well was build upon the structure that Barry had already developed for the film, the journey of Mouse as an empath, as a sensible guy, vulnerable kid, who is depicted also in a coming of age drama that breaks the stereotypes of what we have seen usually black and brown kids coming of age movies be. Like, this is the story, you know, he's a kid from Baltimore, he's from a marginalized part of Baltimore and youth without opportunities, but his hopes and dreams are once of being a vet. You know, not just like, let's go make money and all that stuff that definitely happens and we have seen before, but this kid has a different story to him. And we throwing him into the world that we are familiar with and seeing how that plays also a part into a character, I felt that it was a very important story to tell. And I think that's where Sherman did very well, was to take the spirit of the character of Mouse and his friends and give that teenage banter, that energy, that that comedic tone that goes with being kids and a bully in the streets, and then hit them hard with the realities of becoming a man too early in a crime-infested part of town. So I feel like there was a lot of the spirit that Barry Jenkins left throughout the film, but Sherman did also a very good job in making it his.
Gotcha. And in case some of our listeners, maybe they didn't see the documentary and haven't seen Charm City Kings yet, obviously, you know, we should mention that it follows a bunch of, you know, urban dirt bike riders. A lot of folks, you know, you'll hear dirt bikes, they might think somewhere out in the country in a field with dirt ramps jumping and stuff. But explain how that dirt, you know, dirt bike riding is sort of a, you know, it's its own subculture there in the city.
Correct. No, and not only that, it is when you're there, because I have never experienced something like that. And when I went there, I spent about 7-8 weeks with them, going to the Sunday rides, meeting the people and kind of like figuring out why they do what they do, which is beautiful. It's the same thing people do, a lot of the stuff that they excel. It's passion, dedication, commitment. It's a lot of, you know, being disciplined also and practice. And these kids are artists on their bikes. The stunts that they pull off are impressive. I have never in my life seen somebody tap dance while doing a wheelie. That's kind of like, it's something so unique and powerful that it's a shame that's being criminalized and not you know, using public fundings to build them something that they can practice and excel. We have people like Chino Braxton, who, you know, he's sponsored by Under Armour. He's managed by Roc Nation. Like, he's becoming a pro in this sport that, much like skateboarding or BMX and all this stuff, was seen as vandalism or vilified in the past. Now they're extreme games. The same thing that murals were seen as vandalizing, and now they're an art form. I think the same goes with what these guys do on their bikes. It's definitely an art form.
Awesome. I love the way you put that too. All right, well, dish on the cast a little bit, you know, because, you know, as director, you decided who's going to play Mouse. And tell me who plays Mouse. And, you know, we also have Meek Mill, and the, you know, famous rapper. We have Teyana Paris, who, you know, If Beale Street Could Talk, and Chirac and stuff. Tell me about how great it was working with all those guys.
Well, I'll tell you what, these kids were a dream come true. For me, working with the talents, seeing a star really come up was something spectacular. I'm very happy with the job that the casting director did in doing a nationwide search. We went through Baltimore. We found really good people. We casted a lot of people from Baltimore, but when it came to Mouse, I really wanted to capture his spirit. I really wanted to be able to find someone who really kind of like embodies the whole ethos of the character of Mouse, especially the empath and the vulnerability of an innocent teenager. And that's sometimes really hard to find, especially in that age gap when like 12, 14, and being able to tap into a kid who can hone into different emotions with the professionalism of an old soul, and still hold true to his own experience, which is pretty innocent, being that he is a kid. But I thought that he was pretty much being himself and trying to be somebody he's not, like the kid in the movie. It was very, very impressive to see how he owned it and how he was able to control the character and all the emotional shifts that it goes through. And when it came to Meek Mill, you know, Meek Mill is a great rapper, and he had been already in prison. And while we were working on the film, he was locked up. And when he was released, like a couple months later, that's when we started shooting. And there's nothing more authentic than having a character that went exactly through the same issues that the character of Blacks went through. The only difference in the movie is that Blacks is a mechanic and Nick is a rapper. But everything else, being a person that has been in trouble in probably most of his life, and once he's out, he started to make amends and try to do things right. That's pretty much the same journey that Meek Mill has. And when it came to Teyana Paris, I mean, there's only so much you can say about a pro like her. I learned so much from her, and working with somebody of such caliber in acting, same goes with Catlett, being able to work with that type of caliber, it's something that I didn't know if I would have ever had the experience to do so in my life. So being able to see all these hopes and dreams that I've had coming up as a director play before my eyes was very humbling, and I'm just only filled with gratitude, and I feel blessed by being able to witness such amazing talent develop before my eyes.
Awesome. Now let's geek out a little bit as a couple of cinephiles, you know, a couple of filmmakers. You know, what did you shoot on? What kind of camera? And in terms of just sort of like your style, are you like, you know, what are you going for? You know, Italian neorealism, or you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like what approach did you take as director?
Well, definitely, you know, Italian neorealism informs a lot of my the way that I see life. Not just out of necessity in Puerto Rico, working with, you know, limitations, but I feel that in the sense of being authentic and honest and depicting realities that sometimes are usually presented in a different light with a different bias or in a slapstick manner, being able to like hone into neorealism, I guess, is one of the things that I embrace within my first film. And with here, I wanted to take that up a notch and be able to use tools that wouldn't have otherwise been available for me to use and be able to try at least to create a language that feels authentic to the story we're telling without losing its grasp on reality and realism. And with that, it did help to have Kate Arismendi as the DP. She's a super super badass, sorry, DP that works very hard and also applies a sensibility to her reality that I knew that the film could benefit from. And her eye on the story and her pursuit also of realism and understanding that the language that I wanted to create wasn't one that wanted to only emulate something we'd seen before, but that birthed something new. And we used the Alexa Mini, and I believe she had some custom vintage lenses, Panavision lenses, worked on so that the film could have a little bit of more, the lens could have a little bit more grit to it, a little bit more raw, but it came so that the real colors of Baltimore pops off and it doesn't feel like we were trying to quote unquote Hollywood Baltimore, but let Baltimore have its own accent on the film. Like this wasn't so much about, you know, exploiting a city, but inviting the city to be an active character in the film.
Awesome. And, you know, before we run, sort of in closing, you mentioned earlier in the interview about how, you know, you saw some parallels between, you know, Baltimore up here and where you grew up in Puerto Rico. So I want to know more about, you know, where in Puerto Rico did you grow up? You know, who were your filmmaking idols, when, you know, when you started getting into filmmaking in Puerto Rico? You know, I want to know about you, sir.
Well, yeah, I was born in Santurce. That's a barrio in the capital, San Juan. And most of my childhood I spent in Bairoa, which is a valley in the middle of the island. And as I grew up and I became more independent, I went back to Santurce with my roots and really made my whole life there in terms of the community and what informs my upbringing, which I saw a lot of I pretty much lived on the same, it could have been the same block that Mouse lived in. It was just in a different climate with a different language and different architecture. But all the dynamics, all the tensions, all the temptations, all the hopes and dreams that teenagers have, which tend to be very universal, when informed with the same effects that marginalization has on communities forgotten by the same person, like Puerto Rico being a colony of the U.S. and Baltimore being a city of a state in the U.S., they have both been left for dead. In, you know, using the example of what happened after Maria in Puerto Rico, I'm seeing how you have pockets of Baltimore that are overdeveloped, but the marginalized communities are still stuck back in time. I was able just to see that our struggles are not that different, and that our hopes and dreams to be better and be resilient are the same. And with that connection, you know, finding a story that really spoke to me, and I felt that really navigated the narrative that as a person of color would love to be tackled in a story that depicts us, that could have depicted us in a different way. I feel that opportunity couldn't be lost. And, you know, not just a love letter to Baltimore as a city, but also a love letter to marginalized kids everywhere. And And with that, that was kind of like where I felt I loved the parallels with the story. And when it came to my inspirations growing up and the directors that I love, the constants in my life, I guess, growing up has always been like Scorsese and Spielberg. I remember their films as part of like the first things that I saw in the theaters. I remember seeing Indiana Jones in the theaters. That was my first one. George Lucas with Star Wars. That was my first movie that I saw on cable. And that's how my love for cinema started. But as I grew up, films from Scorsese started to inform more and more a type of American cinema that I was really falling in love with, like the Coppola, Schrader, Brian De Palma. Those were like my heroes growing up in the American cinema. That was until I had the opportunity to experience international cinema. And that's when I started opening my eyes to the films of Almodóvar, Amenábar, and then I started branching out with the, you know, Pasolini and Godard, and then the new Fellini, and then you get like those French cinema that was very powerful. And then the whole new wave of Mexico with Iñárritu, Cuarón, Del Toro. And I started picking up from all of those different, you know, heroes of the craft in my book, and tried to find my own identity also as a director, not only as a director with a visual language, but also as a Puerto Rican who believes, you know, I have my own identity. I am not what my captors say of me. And I can't wait to be able to show the world that we exist, you know, not only when disaster strikes and not only when there's a reboot for West Side Story, but, you know, tell stories also that resonate with our experiences and our realities so that, you know, we can make a world a better place.
Perfect place to leave it. I love that term you used, heroes of the craft. And, you know, maybe there's some young filmmakers that are watching, and, you know, you will be their hero of the craft, sir. So thank you so much. Congrats on, you know, the festival success and getting on HBO Max. And we look forward to, you know, everyone seeing it. It comes out tomorrow. So everyone check it out. Thanks, man.
Thank you.